This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
It was meant to be a defense, a place of refuge for the saints, but unfortunately, it became everything but that. It was Far West Missouri. That's next on the Joseph Smith Papers.
The Mormon Channel presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
After the expulsion of the Mormons from Jackson County, they crossed the Missouri River and they went north into Clay County. But after a time, the same difficulties they'd had there followed them into Clay County and they had to leave. Mormon explorers went to the north and what looked like an area for a good mill site on Shoal Creek became the city of Far West. For a time, it was the headquarters of the church. The Missourians looked at this land and said, if the Mormons want that prairie land, let them have it. And thus began the city of Far West.
Alexander L. Baugh.
Following the failure of Zion's camp to redeem Zion, the saints continued to gather to Clay County for the next 2 years. Actually 1834, 35, and 36. By 1836, however, the citizens of Clay County were a little bit nervous about the continued influx of Mormons into their county. I think they always felt like the stay of the Mormons in Clay County would only be temporary.
Max H. Parkin.
That summer in June and July, the leading officers of Clay County began to hold meetings in the courthouse to determine what they would do with the Mormons, and the determination was that the Mormons must leave.
In these difficult circumstances, the saints went to Missouri Governor Daniel Dunklin for help. But by this time, he had taken a decidedly negative stance against them. He wouldn't help them. Now, they were in a tough spot. The citizens of Clay County wanted them out. And the citizens of Ray County, where they wanted to go, wouldn't let them in.
The other individual who helped us considerably was none other than our attorney, Alexander William Donovan, who at that time was also the Clay County representative to the Missouri legislature. And Donovan came up with, I think, what was a temporary solution to the Mormon problem and our need for land, and that was simply the Mormons have purchased this area in this sparsely settled area of Ray County. Why don't we just create a county for the Mormons? And they all settle there. And I think that was seen as the solution for the Mormon problem. Mormons basically began relocating from all over Missouri, wherever they had been, but most of them from Clay County began moving into Caldwell County and this newly created Caldwell County. And then, of course, they centered their settlement relocation basically in that area, which will be called Far West. But primarily, Caldwell was seen as, I don't like to even use the word, but as a reservation almost for the Mormons.
It was believed by some old settlers that Davis County was not for the Mormons, but only for them, but the Mormons understood it was for them as well.
W.W. Phelps wrote a letter to Joseph Smith, who was still in Kirtland, and he said of their new home, "We shall soon have one of the most precious spots on the globe." As the Mormons saw it, Far West was to be their home for a long time to come, a place where they could reestablish themselves.
The area or region in which they were settling in Caldwell County, although rich and fertile, was not seen as the most desirable land with a considerable amount of timber and water and that kind of thing. But certainly could be tilled, farmed, turned into a productive area. But it probably was seen by most Missourians as less desirable than other more timbered area and more watered area. But it was a, I think the Latter-day Saint leaders could clearly see potential.
So Latter-day Saints in 1836 and 37 will begin to gather to Caldwell County and some to Davis County, and in fact to the other counties around Ray County and Caldwell County and so forth, until they establish about 20 settlements in Caldwell County.
Wow.
With eventually about 5,000 residents of far west and that many more out in the county and the other settlements. And eventually a half a dozen settlements in Davis County as well.
The Mormons bought their land and immediately planned their city after the plat of the original city of Zion in Jackson County. Their intent was to have a temple at the center.
And we have a letter from W.W. Phelps to Joseph Smith, who was living in Kirtland, still in Kirtland. Monday, the 3rd of July, was a great and glorious day in Far West. More than 1,500 saints assembled at this place. And at 8:30 in the morning, after prayer, singing, and an address, they proceeded to break the ground for the Lord's house. The day was beautiful. The Spirit of the Lord was with us. An excavation for this great edifice, 110 feet long by 80 feet broad, was nearly finished. One Missourian said they dug the foundation to the depth of 5 feet in nearly one day. Now, that's 110 feet by 80 feet. Now, just by comparison, the Kirtland Temple was 79 feet by 59 feet. And the Nauvoo Temple was 128 feet by 88 feet. So this temple would only be 8 feet narrower in terms of width and only 18 feet smaller than the Nauvoo Temple. So this was a considerably larger temple anticipated to be built by the Missouri Saints from that of the Kirtland Temple.
Joseph came from Kirtland and visited the Saints in Far West in November of 1837. And among other things, he recommended that they postpone the building of their temple until the Lord had given a revelation on the matter.
The Missouri leaders are anticipating that the centerpiece of this new city, this new Mormon settlement, the showpiece, the centerpiece of the community would be this magnificent temple. Lilburn W. Boggs, now the governor, issued actual commissions, military commissions, to a number of the leading brethren, authorizing them to act in the official capacity as militia officers for the state, of course, with jurisdiction in Caldwell County. So I think it's remarkable that the Mormons are probably feeling pretty good about themselves with the creation of this county. This is going to be a great benefit to us. Not only in the sense of this identity of a Mormon-established county and community, but politically and militarily, we can have some autonomy here.
Far West grew. Eventually, it had 150 houses, four dry goods stores, three family groceries, a half a dozen blacksmith shops, a printing establishment, and two hotels. Far West was prospering. But while it was, Kirtland was troubled with apostasy and dissent.
And the Prophet Joseph Smith will, on the night of the 12th of January, with his counselor Sidney Rigdon, flee from Kirtland for Far West Missouri. It's a hurried and harrowing departure, and they will finally arrive in Far West on the 14th of April, 1838.
And with the arrival of Joseph Smith, the headquarters of the church is now Far West. When Joseph Smith arrived on March 14th, he lived at the home of George Washington Harris. We're not sure exactly how long he was there, but certainly you can imagine the incredible joy, the incredible anticipation to now have Joseph Smith in Missouri. Now, on the other hand, you have to think that the Missourians also were very much aware that Joseph Smith, now a Missouri citizen. And that probably caused them some consternation and, quite frankly, I'm sure in some circles, some alarm. Joseph Smith represented what Mormonism was and the entire Mormon leadership to them marked that this is not a good day for Missourians.
Not all of the dissent was left behind in Kirtland. Because of the actions and the words of certain leaders, there was trouble and disunion among the saints. It became necessary to excommunicate some to preserve union, peace, and love among the saints.
In March, the previous March, the church leaders there had already excommunicated two members of the first of the stake presidency, John Whitmer and W.W. Phelps, for problems associated with their spending the money in managing
misuse of
church funds and those kinds of problems. And they were discharged. Just a couple of days before the Prophet Joseph arrived in Far West, they had also excommunicated Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer. Oliver was excommunicated for reasons of engaging in lawsuits against the church, vexatious lawsuits is what they called them, and also misrepresenting the character of Joseph Smith and other charges. Well, it was a difficult time, but Joseph approved of the trials. The interesting next event that is of most importance to the church is that these apostate brethren now began to create difficulty in Far West, threatened more vexatious lawsuits, and reported things that Joseph felt would begin to raise a mob against the city. And so to protect the city, he wanted them out of the city.
Provocative statements made about these apostates by some church leaders, particularly Sidney Rigdon, ignited the situation and led to the formation of a secret group of men called the Danites. Now, their intent, among other things, was to stamp out this dissent. But they made the situation far worse then and later.
The new organization established, it is not a church organization per se, but kind of an extra ecclesiastical organization established by a private member of the church. His name was Samson Avard. Samson Avard was a prominent elder in the church, and he established a group of loyalists, at this time 83 of them that had signed a covert a document indicating they would be loyal to one another. And this group will function privately, not as a institutional arm of the church, but as an extra functionary group. Therefore, they're the ones that use the necessary muscle to persuade the dissenters to leave the city. And they were forced
muscle.
Out with muscle indeed, and they were forced out, terrified, in fact, to leave and to depart from their mischief in the city. The second objective was to later help the saints and to protect them and assist them whenever they had need. That was to be a passive kind of assistance. But thirdly, and this the prophet did not know about, the prophet later will have to learn of this only later when he's in prison himself, and that is that their third objective is to overtly and aggressively act against the mobs and against the villagers in Upper Missouri in retaliation of what the saints had suffered.
Like a vigilante mob?
Like a vigilante group, and they're known as the Danites.
Those early days in Far West were a happy and a hopeful time for the saints. It was during that period that a number of revelations were received that came to be very significant.
The first revelation received by Joseph Smith at Far West is the revelation, section 113, in our present-day Doctrine and Covenants. And this was probably given at the home of George Washington Harris. It's an interesting section. It's an interesting revelation in that you can tell that probably what happened was a number of the brethren are anxious to have Joseph Smith with them, and they probably missed having his biblical knowledge and prophetic insight to the Scriptures. And it's quite interesting that they would ask a series of questions, and the questions that these brethren asked Joseph Smith on this occasion, centered in Isaiah chapter 11, some of the opening verses related to that particular chapter, and also Isaiah chapter 52. The next section that was received by Joseph Smith at Far West is section 114. And this is an interesting section because it's addressed to David Patton, who's, of course, the second in terms of seniority in the Quorum of the Twelve. And it basically tells David Patton to prepare himself for a mission the following spring with 12 others, including himself, to testify of my name and bear glad tidings unto the world. That mission, of course, that we later understood would be the mission of the 12 to Great Britain. Unfortunately, Patton was killed in October of 1838 at the battle or skirmish that took place at Crooked River.
There were general revelations that would affect the whole church, but there were other revelations that were given to individuals giving specific directions. These were uncanonized or not written into the canon of Scripture.
On that same day, April 17, 1838, is an uncanonized revelation. It's not in our Doctrine and Covenants. It was directed to Brigham Young. And basically all it said was that Brigham Young was to take his residency of his family, take his residency up at Mill Creek, located about 3 miles from Far West. You can see why it wasn't canonized. It's not a significant revelation in terms of the church. It was just kind of a personal revelation to Brigham. But I think I see a long-term benefit from that. And what is interesting is at the time of the Mormon arrests, when the Mormons finally surrender to Missouri authorities, they don't come after Brigham Young. He's out of town. Section 115 is an incredible section in the Doctrine and Covenants. And the date, of course, is April 26th, 1838. First of all, the opening verse indicates that Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, and Hiram Smith are the first presidency of the church. That's significant because the person missing, or the person who was Joseph Smith's counselor, Frederick G. Williams, has now been replaced by Joseph's own brother, Hiram. But I think what is really significant is verse 4. Actually, we could begin in verse 3. And also unto my faithful servants who are of the high council of my church in Zion, that's the Missouri High Council, for thus it shall be called, and unto all the elders and people of my church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints scattered abroad in all the world. And here's the verse. For thus shall my church be called in the last days, even the church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Section 115 continues with the instructions now to go ahead with the building of the temple. And let the beginning be made on the fourth day of July next, July 4th, 1838. And from that time forth, let my people labor diligently to build a house unto my name. And in 1 year from this day, April 26th, 1838, so now we're jumping ahead to April 26th, 1839, thus let them from that time forth labor diligently until it shall be finished, from the cornerstone thereof and the top thereof, until there shall not anything remain that is not finished. So what he's saying here is, let's move ahead on July 4th. Let's dedicate the actual temple site. And I think what the Lord fully anticipated, that the saints would now then make preparations, get stone, get timber, get the necessary equipment put together, get all the things necessary to build this temple, and let's commence it again, or actually begin the temple activity and temple construction beginning April 26, 1839. Well, as all Latter-day Saints should know or do know, that was impossible, considering the fact that, of course, in the intervening time, the saints had this the Missouri Mormon War, and, of course, were expelled from Missouri.
By May of 1838, the city of Far West had tripled in population. Therefore, Joseph and some others set out to lay claims, they said, to lands to facilitate the gathering of the saints. He went north up into Daviess County to a beautiful spot on the Grand River. While he was there, he received Section 116 of the Doctrine and Covenants.
Spring Hill, or the area where Lyman White is living, is named by the Lord Adam on Diamond because, said he, it is the place where Adam shall come to visit his people, or the Ancient of Days shall sit, as spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Adam, signifying Adam, the first man. Amun, signifying God. Ondai, the presence of. So Adam in the presence of God. I think that would be a loose interpretation. The area was this region was called that because Adam lived here in the presence of God, or established his home.
July the 8th, 1838. On this date, Joseph Smith received five revelations, four of which are recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants. The first of these, Section 117, we've already discussed. It's about Oliver Granger, the first presidency's agent back in Kirtland.
I think it's significant, too, that Oliver Granger is told in this revelation to act in behalf of the first presidency in trying to settle some of the debts that Joseph Smith had to leave behind, or some of his unfinished business affairs. And I think Oliver Granger was a dutiful and faithful servant and tried to do that. Section 118 is another revelation of Joseph Smith given on July 8th, 1838. And this one is in direct reference to the fact that now the Lord has called the remainder of the 12 to go on this mission, the anticipated mission of the 12 to Great Britain, the follow-up mission to that of Orson Hyde and Heber C. Kimball. And they, of course, were to take every effort possible to prepare themselves so that they could leave their families by April 26th, 1839. And they were to commence that mission by taking their departure from Far West on that date from the spot of the Lord's Temple, the Far West Temple site.
The church, as the saints gathered there to Far West and didn't have money enough to pay for its expenses and to acquire all the land they wanted to acquire and these other concerns. So consequently, the bishop and his council in the church reviewed ways that they could raise funds, and one of them was that they would impose upon the church a tithe of 2% of all the assets that they had as they came into the county from Kirtland and from other places in the east. This was considered and evaluated, and some proposals were made. And then the prophet Joseph Smith, under revelation, came up with the Lord's answer to their concern. And that revelation is this. Joseph asks a specific question. O Lord, show unto thy servant how much thou requirest of the properties of thy people for a tithing. Answer, verily, thus saith the Lord, I require all their surplus property to be put into the hands of the bishop of my church of Zion for the building of mine house, the temple, and for the laying foundation of Zion, and for the priesthood, and for the debts of the presidency of my church. And this shall be the beginning of the tithing of my people. Now, most of them didn't have much surplus, but they would have some. The revelation continues on with the second part. And this shall be the beginning of the tithing of my people, as I said. And after that, those who have thus been tithed shall pay one-tenth of all their interest annually. And so the two aspects of the law that was given then was to surrender their surplus, number one, and number two, then subsequently to pay a tenth of all their earnings in the future. This was not just a temporary program, and this was also not just an inferior law to the law of consecration. This is really an extension of the law of consecration. They are to consecrate their surplus. We do not do that today, but they were asked to do that then because of the great need, and they were to consecrate a tenth of their income from then on. And that is the beginning of the law of tithing in the church.
Now, you'll remember that the Revelation had told the saints about the temple that they were to begin work on the 4th of July next. Well, in accordance with that, they held a grand patriotic celebration.
Joseph Smith opened the ceremony with prayer, after which they decided to do a dedication of each of the cornerstones, beginning with the southeast cornerstone. It was on this occasion that Sidney Rigdon gave his famous July 4th sermon. Very, very patriotic, talking about, of course, the faith of the forefathers and the history of the founding fathers of this country. And it's very, very patriotic. Unfortunately, at the very end, he became a little bit vitriolic and said some things that were not wise.
George Robinson was Prophet Joseph Smith's clerk and recorded for the prophet in his journal this statement, July the 4th, 1838. This day was spent in celebrating the 4th of July in commemoration of the Declaration of Independence of the United States of America, and also to make our Declaration of Independence from all mobs and persecution which have been influenced upon us. Now, the church will like it so much that the church newspaper, the Elders' Journal, will publish it in a pamphlet form and be published and circulated throughout the church and, of course, by others, two others as well. And they'll read it and will emphasize certain parts. The parts perhaps that they will read and emphasize are these. He says, in effect, mobs are not to come upon us again. And Sidney continued, and that mob that comes on us to disturb us, it shall be between us and them a war of extermination. For we will follow them until the last drop of their blood is spilled, or else they will have to exterminate us. For we will carry the seat of war to their own houses and their own families, and one party or the other shall be utterly destroyed.
And so it was unwise, but nonetheless it was part of the temple dedication activities.
In just a little over 3 months, Sidney Rigdon's volatile words would echo in an order signed by Missouri Governor Lilburn W. Boggs. The Mormons, he said, must be treated as enemies and must be exterminated or driven from the state if necessary for the public peace. Their outrages are beyond all description. Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, War in Northern Missouri. I'm Glenn Rossi. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel.